Dr. Paul here. Can you believe it? It is show 20. Against the Wind, Doctors and Science Under Fire. When I started this program at the beginning of this year, I had no idea we'd be already rolling into show 20. This is one you're not going to want to miss. Stephanie Seneff, who wrote Toxic Legacy, How the Weed Killer Glyphosate is Destroying Our Health and Environment, is talking to us about COVID. She is actually now one of the world's top researchers in the area of COVID. Do not miss a thing she has to say. It's going to blow your mind. I then interview Neil Miller, Critical Vaccine Studies. This guy has researched and documented and published himself multiple articles on vaccine safety. He knows the data. He's going to cover the vaxxed, unvaxxed issue, SIDS, and also touch on COVID in a way that you're going to want to hear. And of course, don't miss our roundup with Bernadette, who brings us in the news what you're not getting on social media. This is the information you need that you're not getting on mainstream news, you're not getting in the usual social media channels. Enjoy the show. I'm Dr. Paul. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. This week, I am challenged with a conflicted feeling I'm having within my own self and my spirit. On the one hand, I feel like I'm going through the absolute most important time in my life, where I'm opening up to the presence of love in my life, presence to guidance like I've never had before, and the sense of fulfilling purpose in my life. But on the other hand, I'm under this incredible pressure in my career. And most of all, I just want to help my patients, and I want to be able to be informative and educational for you, the viewers, and those who choose to access the information I have. So here are a couple things that have happened. Those of you who've been watching this show know my license was taken last December, an emergency removal of my license that appeared to be in response retaliation to publishing an article, basically the largest vaxxed, unvaxxed study, the real-world data from my practice. Well, the license was reinstated June 3rd, and I'm back in the clinic. So that felt wonderful. It was reinstated, I think, on legal technicalities because they had not filed any charges against me when they removed my license. Long story short, I'm back in the trenches. I'm happy to be doing what I love, taking care of patients. I'm a pediatrician. I love taking care of kids. I got a notice from my office manager that there was a complaint from a long-standing patient. And the complaint was they didn't want to see me because I had had my license revoked and I was disciplined by the board. Secondly, I shared some information about what you could do if you got COVID that was not what the mainstream is preaching on the television. And it was like, okay, big sigh. I felt this conflict within myself because I want to be informative, I want to be educational, I want to be informational. That's what this show is all about. But then I'm reminded, as I'm often reminded, that we have to meet people where they're at, because if I'm coming across as preaching, for example, that's probably not going to be well received. So, lesson learned once again. The flip side of that is I just got back from a conference where I was speaking to over 150 physicians at the International College of Integrative Medicine meeting. And it was so delightful to be in a room with intelligent, educated, integrative physicians who totally understand what's going on. The conundrum for us is that we know what's going on, and we have the scientific data, we have the research to know with relative certainty that it is absolutely not what people are being told on television or on social media. And so we have this huge divide in what people know and therefore how people respond to this COVID epidemic that our world and our country is seeing. When I said epidemic, I am not implying that this is not a rough time for a lot of people, and that people have died and continue to die from SARS-CoV-2 or some response or lack of treatment for SARS-CoV-2. What's so clear and what we continue to provide for you on this show is the fact that we do have really good, effective ways of reducing your risk, minimizing the chance that you have any harm from this virus, and should you get very sick, there are things you can do. So that's what we focus on here. This is a show that's focused on the science and focused on bringing you real solutions. I'm glad to be a part of that. I hope you enjoy the show. I'm Dr. Paul. Welcome, Stephanie Seneff, to Against the Wind. It's such an honor and privilege to have you on the show.
So great to be here. Thank you.
You are a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab. Since 2010, your research has focused on the effects of drugs, toxic chemicals, and diet on human health and disease. And you've written and spoken extensively on these subjects. You've authored 36 peer-reviewed journal papers on topics related to human disease, nutritional deficiencies, and toxic exposures. What I was so excited about was your new book, this one here. That I couldn't put it down. I've known that glyphosate was an issue, but you just outlined with the science why we should all be concerned about glyphosate. Having heard you speak when we were together just this past weekend, I became aware that you are really, really well versed and have done a lot of research on the new vaccines for COVID. And I thought your information and knowledge would be important for our audience. You believe that the mRNA vaccines offer more risk than benefit to everybody who receives them, including the elderly. I know Peter McCullough has expressed the same thing as well. Can you explain why you take this position?
Yes, I've done a deep dive into the details of these messenger RNA vaccines, and I believe they are extremely toxic. And a lot of it has to do with all the manipulations that they made on the product. I mean, it's a completely not natural system. They've created this monster messenger RNA molecule that pretends to be human by the changes that they made in the messenger RNA that normally would be a virus messenger RNA. They turn it into a human messenger RNA. That's very important because it means it misses the signals. Usually when the cell receives a viral messenger RNA, it knows it's virus and it reacts to it with appropriate responses. But this is super, super stealth because it goes past the mucosal barriers, past the blood barriers, directly into the muscles. It's this strange messenger RNA that looks human. It gets taken up by the cells. It's been designed so well, not only to be able to make spike protein really quickly, so they've manipulated it so as to do that, and also they've manipulated it so it can't break down. So they make it very sturdy. Normally, enzymes outside the cells would have completely disintegrated the messenger RNA before it ever got inside. So they have to put in this toxic synthetic cationic lipid, which is really toxic to the cells and causes them to get very upset and acts like aluminum in many of the vaccines. People are familiar with aluminum as an adjuvant, something that irritates the cells because it has to draw in the immune cells to get that antibody response to work. So the muscle cells are really hit hard by this monstrous toxic stuff that's packaged up with this polyethylene glycol and cationic lipids and crazy messenger RNA that's been altered so that many of the nucleotides are not even natural nucleotides. I mean, it's really, really mucked around with so as to make it very capable of making lots and lots of spike protein in a hurry and resisting getting broken down.
Yeah. So are you referring to what I've read about called nanoparticles as far as the way that it sort of stealth gets through the normal barriers?
That is correct. And in fact, it looks enough like an LDL particle. If you're familiar with LDL, that's the classic lipid particle that, gosh, you've got high LDL, you need to take a cholesterol lowering drug.
Right.
They make this look like an LDL particle. They carefully design it to be like an LDL particle. And that means it gets taken up through natural mechanisms by many cells. It's not even like the ACE2 receptor, which the virus is specific to the ACE2 receptor. That's not the case here. It can just go right in through natural endocytosis. And then it is designed with that cationic lipid to open up like a flower and release those messenger RNA molecules ready to go. Boom, boom, start making that spike protein. The cell can't turn it off. It doesn't have any mechanisms to turn it off because the whole thing has been designed in that way. It's very clever engineering with the goal of producing extremely high antibody response to the spike protein, which it succeeds royally at. It does a very good job of making extremely high spike protein antibodies, which is not a good idea because high antibody levels leads to autoimmune disease. It's much, much higher, in fact, 10 times higher than what you get from a natural infection.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, being a pediatrician, I've been very much in the vaccine world because that's so much of what we do. And we've always been taught, you know, the higher the antibody response, the better. But I sure noticed that when I was doing measles, mumps, rubella titers, that there were titers just off the wall in some kids, and it didn't seem to be a good thing.
Right.
So yeah, it feels like for COVID, for this SARS-CoV-2 virus, the natural defense mechanisms aren't really antibody-based as much. What's your take on that?
No, that's very interesting, in fact, because I've seen, there was a nice study that looked at the antibody response to different degrees of illness. So people who got COVID got, you know, tested positive, didn't have any symptoms, versus people who tested positive, ended up in the hospital and died, you know, these sort of extreme cases. Different people react very differently to the virus. They looked at the antibody response in those different degrees of disease, and they found systematically the highest antibody response occurred in the most devastating disease. Mm-hmm. And the ones who had practically no reaction also got no antibodies. So the antibodies are an adaptive response that kicks in when the innate immune system fails. Mm-hmm. And the innate immune system fails when it's exposed to glyphosate. This is what I've been saying. Glyphosate in our country is wrecking our immune system. And that's why the U.S. is having so much trouble controlling COVID-19. We have a remarkably high death rate across the globe. Our death rate from COVID is four times as high as the average.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're not doing well. And that's because, you know, we're fat. We've got diabetes. Those are conditions that are risk factors for COVID and also caused by glyphosate. And I wrote about that in my book.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting to make that connection. Now, vaccinologists have been warning about the possibility of antibody-dependent enhancement, what they call ADE, that this is showing up in vaccinated people once antibody levels start to fade. Can you explain what this is and whether you see any evidence that this is actually happening with these mRNA vaccines?
Yes, this is a very serious concern, and many experts are raising the alarm about the possibility that this is going to happen. And so far, most of the news has been good news. I mean, people have said, now they're saying, well, you know, the vaccine doesn't really protect you from getting infected. They're seeing that, they're admitting that. You still get infected, you still spread disease, but the good news is your disease is mild. It's going to reduce your symptoms. That's what they're telling people. Now, get the vaccine because it's going to reduce your symptoms, not because it's going to stop the spread of COVID. Mm-hmm. They've weakened, you know, with their statement. And what we're seeing is that's starting to, we're starting to see warts in that idea. And there are experts who have suspected this is going to happen. And there are studies that show that the vaccine-based antibodies, they start out sky high. Really, really good antibodies, and, you know, good meaning that it'll protect you from the disease. It'll cause autoimmune disease at the same time, but never mind that. The antibody levels start falling very rapidly with the vaccine, whereas when you get the disease and recover, your antibody level starts out much lower, but it fades very slowly. So after a certain amount of time, there's a crossover. This is going fat, that's coming down. There's a crossover where you no longer have that protection. After maybe 6 months, it's way down. In the vaccinated population. So now, okay, booster shot, everybody. And every 6 months, get a booster shot. And of course, there's also the problem of these resistant strains, like the Delta strain.
Yeah.
It's now taken over the American, practically all the cases are Delta now in America. That happened very quickly. And so the antibody-dependent enhancement is very, very interesting because as the antibodies fall, there's basically two kinds of antibodies. You know, ones that protect from disease and ones that enhance disease. And what happens is the ones that protect fall faster than the ones that enhance. Mm. And you reach a crossover point where if you've been vaccinated, all of a sudden you're starting to see worse disease as a consequence of the vaccine compared to no vaccine at all. Once there's been time that has elapsed, it's quite remarkable. And it's quite fascinating science because these antibodies, these non-neutralizing antibodies, they're called, and they attach to the virus. And then they are the thing that hooks up to the receptor on the cell, these Fc gamma receptors. And so they facilitate viral entry through a different pathway from the ACE2 receptor. And it comes in and it multiplies, the virus spreads. And they also form these conglomerates of viruses plus this antibody that induces a very strong immune response. And this is this sort of cytokine storm problem that we see where there's too many, you know, toxic things being released by the cells to try to kill the viruses, which actually does collateral damage on the tissues. And so you get the lung damage that's associated with severe disease. So I am predicting, and I hope I'm wrong, that we're going to have a rough time in the fall as so many people have their levels wane and people are going to be scrambling to get booster shots. And you can't just keep on keeping those antibodies really high because you're going to end up with nasty autoimmune diseases. This virus, that protein has many sequences that are similar to sequences in human proteins that are associated with nasty autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis and lupus and Hashimoto's thyroiditis and celiac disease. I mean, all these diseases that are caused by the immune system attacking the human cells. Yeah. And this is what happens when the antibody levels are too high.
I share your concern.
Between a rock and a hard place, because they're like, oh my God, I got to get another vaccine. My antibodies are falling. And then they're just going to get all their autoimmune diseases. So it's really, really nasty, I think.
Yeah. So do we get antibody dependent enhancement with natural infection?
Well, it doesn't look that way. And a lot of it is because a natural infection has a much broader base of response. And many of it is not actually antibodies. So I think the antibodies are a last resort when the immune system has failed. And of course, with the vaccine, the cells are fooled into thinking that the immune system has failed because it's gotten past all those barriers, including the messenger RNA barrier, because normally you would have a reaction to the RNA of the virus to say, oh, this is viral RNA. I need to get busy setting up this immune response. That doesn't happen either because it looks like a human RNA. So it's really, really deception to the cells. The immune system thinks, oh my God, the innate immune system is completely shot. There's no innate immune system here. I've got to get all these antibodies. That's the only chance we have.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it knows it's going to cause autoimmune disease, but that's the price you have to pay for having a broken immune system.
Yeah.
Wow. And then some people have a broken immune system on top of it. Those who've been exposed to glyphosate. Mm. It's pretty hideous, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going to be, it's going to be a rough ride, I think, in the fall. I really hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, there's already evidence in Israel. Israel's a good place to watch because they got their vaccines very fast, very early. So they're getting a waiting situation much earlier than other folks are. And there was a really interesting article that I just read about a hospital in Israel. I don't know if you heard about this, a hospital in Israel where they had an outbreak of Delta. Uh-huh. In the hospital, they had like 96% vaccine coverage among the patients and the employees. It was the index case was a fully vaccinated person, and they came in with, you know, symptoms. Nobody thought it was COVID because, of course, they're vaccinated, they're safe, right. You know, so they're spreading it around. Nobody's noticing that they've got COVID. And so by the time they recognized the index case, they had a big problem. A quarter of the patients got COVID. Most of them were vaccinated. There were two patients who got COVID who were unvaccinated. They had mild disease.
Yeah.
Five patients died who were fully vaccinated. So it was not like, oh, it's protecting you from, you know, severe disease. It didn't happen.
Yeah.
So that's really worrisome, you know?
It is. That sounds almost like the Vietnam paper as well, where they had a
I heard about that one too.
Outbreak.
Similar. Yeah. When you get a situation where people are in the hospital, that means they're probably pretty sick anyway. And then their vaccine antibodies are fading and they're in this opportunistic moment where Delta can do a good job on them. It's really sad. So,
yeah. So the unvaccinated are being blamed for the emergence of resistant variants, but you believe it's actually the vaccinated who are causing this problem. Can you explain the science behind that?
Yes, quite interesting there too, as well. And I, you know, so I wrote a paper together with Dr. Greg Nye. We published over 40 pages, many, many references, analyzing our predictions about these vaccines. And we wrote that paper before it was at all clear that what was going on, because it was early. But we wrote a section where we proposed that these vaccines, we predicted that they would cause the emergence of many different variants. And we argued it from the standpoint of a patient. There was a very interesting article from the UK where there was a cancer patient. They were taking immune suppressing therapy, which people often do when they have cancer. So they had a weak immune system. They caught COVID. They were very sick. They were in the hospital for 101 days. Over the course of that time, they were infectious the whole time. So they had them in an isolation room. And this patient was treated twice with basically serum from recovered patients with the hope that would give them antibodies. You know, they didn't have a chance to make their own because their body's so sick. Mm-hmm. Give them antibodies that somebody else made to help them fight disease. It didn't work. They still died. But they were tracking the version of the virus in that patient's body over the whole time. And they saw the remarkable emergence of variants after they had administered the antibodies. The antibodies seemed to trigger a response from the virus that allowed it to change into different forms quickly. It's kind of natural evolution because the antibodies are killing off the ones that are most susceptible to them, and the ones that are left behind survive and flourish, you know. And so they ended up with a particular strain, their dominant strain in their body at the end. There was one strain that had won out over all the others. It had 12 different mutations in the spike protein compared to the original. Really shocking, 12 mutations in one body over the 101 days. And so I think that people who have cancer, who are immune compromised, they're encouraging them, oh yeah, get the vaccine, maybe get three because, you know, you have such a weak immune system. That's giving the virus, if they catch the disease, it gives the virus a tremendous opportunity to hone its skills against those particular antibodies that match the original spike protein. So, it turned out in studies, they've shown that all of a sudden, all the variants start blossoming out after a country starts initiating a vaccination program. It's very much looking that way, like the vaccines are encouraging the virus to mutate into forms that are resistant to the vaccine antibodies, which then means that the person who has the antibodies to spike has the antibodies to the wrong spike, doesn't work. In fact, the Delta variant has rigged itself such that it binds less well to the neutralizing antibodies and it binds better to the enhancing antibodies than the original virus. And so really, really nasty situation going on there that I think is really scary.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, in hindsight, I mean, when this first hit us, we didn't know what we were dealing with. So you sort of think, well, we'll give the public health officials and the vaccine manufacturers some leeway here. Maybe they've got a good product that'll help us. I think we know different now. Can we vaccinate ourselves out of this problem?
I don't think so. I think I can picture a really grim future in which we are jumping up for antibodies for vaccines every 6 months to try to keep those antibody levels high. People are scrambling to get the renewal of their vaccine. In fact, if they're going to keep these vaccine passports, they're going to say, well, you got your vaccine 6 months ago. That doesn't work anymore. You got to go renew your passport. And you can't renew it unless you get another booster shot. And people are going to get worse and worse reactions to the vaccines. I mean, the vaccines have incredible reactions being reported in the VAERS database over the top. Yeah. You know, there's more deaths reported with the COVID vaccines than all the other vaccines over the history of 30 years of collecting data. All of those combined have fewer deaths than the deaths so far reported with the COVID-19 vaccines. And most people think that the VAERS database is grossly underrepresented, underrepresentative of the truth, underreported.
It seems like when you get a natural-based immunity, so you actually get COVID-19 or the SARS-CoV-2 infection, your immune system responds to the entire sequence. And so when there are variants, I'm thinking, and I know you're a stronger scientist than I am on this, that your immunity you'll have a better chance against variants if you're unvaccinated.
I can explain that actually. It's really, really cool because a person who recovers from the disease, I told you the antibodies fade much more slowly, right? But it's not just the spike protein. The virus consists of a lot of other things besides the spike protein. And there are many internal proteins that the virus produces that are very stable across different variants. And it's really fascinating that there are these T cells that can become memory T cells to remember the internal proteins of the virus. And so that's a much safer thing to remember because it doesn't change between the variants. So now you've got the Delta variant coming in. Those T cells immediately recognize it because it's got the same internal proteins. And they get busy trying to get the B cells to make fresh antibodies that are going to match the spike protein that has changed. So instead of having all these antibodies that are going to cause autoimmune disease, you have these very smart T cells that are watching out for the internal proteins. And as soon as they see them, boom, you get those B cells going with the antibodies. So it's a memory T cell can last 17 years, whereas the antibodies fade after 6 months. Very hardy long-term memory.
Yeah. Do you think that's part of the explanation of why children seem to be doing so well, that innate immunity?
There's the cold virus, you know, has many different strains. This is a cold virus, and kids catch colds a lot. Mm-hmm. And those internal proteins are probably working to help them have protection from the coronavirus that we're stuck with right now. So I think
So these mRNA vaccines are causing human cells to produce these abundant levels of spike protein uncontrollably. Evidence exists to show that the spike protein is the most toxic part of the virus. How might the spike protein produced from the vaccine cause myocarditis in young people who have little risk of harm from the virus? And what other conditions might this spike protein be causing?
Right. The spike protein is very, very interesting, and it's extremely toxic. And multiple studies have shown that the spike protein alone, for example, it's neurotoxic. People have done experiments where they expose neurons to the spike protein, and the neurons get sick. The immune cells in the brain, microglia are the immune cells of the brain. They respond to the spike protein by inducing an inflammatory response. So that gives you this sort of encephalopathy in the brain, which can destroy the neurons. And the brain and the heart are really sensitive to this vaccine. There's been a lot of evidence from the reactions. And this myocarditis is really disturbing because the kids are getting much higher rate of myocarditis. Even just from the RARS reports, they're getting the rate of myocarditis immediately makes it clear that the vaccine, risk versus benefit, risk wins. You do not want to get that vaccine if you're young, because you have almost zero chance of dying from COVID-19. And that vaccine can really, really mess you up. It can give you permanent heart damage with that myocarditis. And it's really fascinating how it works. I love the biology of everything. And I tell you, these monster chemicals are causing me to do deep dives into the details of how biology works, and which is good. It's motivating.
I'm just smiling because you are a scientist and you love biology, and the more toxic, the more dangerous it excites you. It's sort of like, as a pediatrician, I always get excited. The sicker the patient, it's like, all right, let's figure this out.
So
more on the spike protein though. Why would we be, I just don't understand why the vaccinologists in this case are creating a vaccine that allows our body to make more of something that apparently is so toxic. Can you explain that at all?
I cannot explain that. I cannot understand how these people, they have to know what I know. I mean, it didn't take me a whole lot of time. They've been doing this research all their lives. You know, I only started researching these vaccines last December.
Yeah.
And yet I see, you know, how dangerous this protein is. This spike protein is unique in its ability to chop itself in half, and it produces an S1 and an S2 component. And that happens with this furin cleavage site, which is a peculiar site that's got 12 nucleotides that are exact. People know that's a furin cleavage site. Mm-hmm. It's stuck in there. It makes it look like it's a synthetic virus. It gives you a lot of suspicion about it coming out of a virology lab, which a lot of people are saying. But that furin cleavage site's very, very dangerous, because what happens is these muscle cells, you know, they get all this spike protein. They're overwhelmed with it. They stick it out on their membrane. They stick it all around the cell. And it's S1 and S2. Then the furin comes along and chops off S1. S1 gets released into the circulation. S1 goes over to the muscle, to the heart, and it binds the ACE2 receptors in the heart and disables them. It's well known. It's all very well established in the research literature. And when you disable ACE2, you get myocarditis. So it's a very, very simple mechanism is how it works. And they've shown S1 shows up in the blood. A couple of days after vaccination, you've got S1 circulating in your blood. And they've shown it can last for 28 days after the vaccine. And so that whole time, S1 is sticking to ACE2 receptors and causing trouble, probably both in the heart and in the brain. And I would argue that it goes to the heart and brain preferentially, because the immune cells, they rush into the spleen. And we talked about this in our paper. So fascinating. When they see this, oh my God, things are terrible. There's this crazy poison coming out of these muscle cells. We don't know how they got to make it, you know? And it rushes it into the spleen to say, hey, B cells, make your antibodies. Just, you know, get these antibodies going. We got to get rid of this stuff. And tons of them, right? And meanwhile, the immune cells are making spike protein, and they're sticking it out and they're throwing it out into exosomes, and it's traveling. Exosomes travel very well along the vagus nerve. So the exosomes are being poured out of these immune cells in the spleen, struggling with all this spike protein that they're now making, because they've taken up the messenger RNA as well. And those exosomes travel along the vagus nerve to the heart and to the brain. And in both places, they're extremely toxic. And so those exosomes get taken up by the cells that are there. And then those guys are stuck with spike protein that they can't handle. And the S1 disables the ACE2 receptors in both places. It's really big trouble. For example, the substantia nigra in the brain has lots of ACE2 receptors. And that's the place where when that gets in trouble, you've got Parkinson's disease. And I think these vaccines are going to cause a tremendous increase in the number of people who have Parkinson's, and people are going to be getting it younger and younger. I think especially if we get booster shots every 6 months, we're going to have 35-year-olds with Parkinson's disease.
Wow. That might explain some of the videos we're seeing on YouTube where youngish, you know, younger middle-aged people can barely walk.
Right. There's a lot of evidence in VARS. I've been looking through the VARS database. It's just horrendous numbers of different reactions that are just shocking. And many of them have to do with immobility.
Yeah. I've read some things about that this vaccine is actually inserting this into our genetics, like permanently changing our genome. Is that happening?
I think it is. That's another one that I'm really fascinated with. And we wrote about that in our paper as well. I was particularly struck by a paper I found that was, I think it was maybe 2010 or something, quite a long time before COVID had hit. It was on the sperm. And it talked about the sperm having the capability to take in messenger RNA, foreign messenger RNA, which is what this is, convert it into DNA, wrap it up inside these plasmids, which are little particles, they're little nanoparticles, really, these plasmids, release the plasmids, and the sperm would release the plasmids at the time of fertilization, and all the sperm, not just the one that fertilized the egg, you know, all of them, releasing these plasmids, the egg, the fertilized egg takes them up, and they become a permanent part. Permanent thing inside that person's body. As that fetus grows up, when it's born, it's got lots of these plasmids all over its body. It can pass them on to its future generations. So that they'll stick around. Those are external to the genome. Independent cDNA, circular DNA stuck inside these plasmids. They're able to reproduce themselves, so they can just keep on going. So that child is born, first of all, with the knowledge that the spike protein is a human protein. Wow. That's what they're going to think. So if they catch COVID, they're not going to react to it at all. So they'll be, I don't know how sick they'll get, because a lot of the sickness has to do with this cytokine storm. So maybe they won't even get sick, but they'll spread the disease like crazy because they won't be able to fight it off.
Well, and I've been reading that spike protein has this tendency to go to the testes and ovaries, for example.
Yes.
So what's that going to mean for future fertility? And
I know I'm very worried about that. And in fact, there's lots and lots of cases of miscarriage. You know, people get stupidly getting it while they're pregnant. I mean, the government says, oh yeah, sure, get it, no problem. Shocking, because they never studied it in pregnancy.
Right.
It goes to the ovaries. That was shown in a study in Japan. There was a FOIA request from Canadian doctors where they got this Pfizer study, because Japan requested that they find out where does the RNA go, because they were saying, oh yeah, it just stays in the muscle. Not true at all. And it went to the spleen, but the highest levels went to the spleen. That's what I was talking about. It goes to the spleen to make the antibodies. But then the second highest in the females was the ovaries. That was really, really shocking to me.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, because people are having, menstrual cycle difficulties, heavy menstrual bleeding, irregular periods. People who never had irregular periods their whole life, all of a sudden they get their period, you know, out of step. I mean, very scary with respect to reproduction. Also swollen testicles. I've seen that, because I said I'm rummaging through the VARS database, and it's just all kinds of things you don't want to know about that are happening.
Yeah.
So I think the reproductive system could be at great issue here. I think we could be causing a massive infertility crisis in the future generations. Especially when we start vaccinating 5-year-old kids. I mean, I cannot believe that we're saying, fine, this is great, let's roll it out for the kids. Let's make it obligatory for school. I mean, California's already decided, you know, Newsom, if they approve it, we're going to make it required for school. I can't believe it. I just cannot believe it. I'm in such a state of shock about everything that's happened over these past 2 years. I'm just in a complete state of shock. I don't understand how people can be so stupid. I really don't. It just infuriates.
Oh my gosh. Folks, you are listening to MIT world leading expert now on SARS-CoV-2 and COVID and what this vaccine does. Dr. Stephanie Senoff, what are your parting words of advice to anybody who's listening who still has not yet taken this vaccine?
I'm sure they know what my advice is. Don't go near it. Don't ever take it. I mean, I'm at MIT. MIT requires it. And I'm among the very small percentage of the population that hasn't gotten the vaccine. I've assured them that I will not go to work. So I work completely from home. I can't go to the office because I haven't been vaccinated. It's so crazy. So far, so good. They haven't said yes. They haven't said no. So I'm hoping that I can keep my job.
Right. Now, so many scientists who speak out on this, as just you and I are speaking, sort of just sharing peer-reviewed information, knowledge that's common to scientists and physicians around the world, but is for some reason our medical societies, our public health officials, our government officials don't want us talking about this. So we usually become targets. Have you yourself had any sort of censorship or career problems?
Well, I've gotten thrown off of Facebook for too many posts against the vaccines. I certainly have plenty of people who are making sure people know that I am a nutcase, you know, or that I'm not qualified. I mean, these kinds of things. They're certainly trying to discredit me on the web. MIT has been wonderful. They have not tried to stop me at all. In fact, I would say my boss has even encouraged me to do this. And the people who are funding me love my research. They feel it's very important. They're from Taiwan. It's a company, computer company in Taiwan. They funded me for many, many years. Even before I was into glyphosate, they were funding me. I switched over to glyphosate and vaccines and all human health at back around 2007 timeframe. I basically changed my career course, and it's been a really amazing experience. And I've learned so much about biology. I'm very excited about the knowledge I'm acquiring of how life works and how it gets disrupted by toxic exposures. And we have to face up to that because it's not just these vaccines. I mean, I never thought I would see something worse than glyphosate, but I think these vaccines are worse than glyphosate. Yeah. My new passion. So we'll see where that goes. But man, it's a tough world out there right now. So, you know, get your certified organic diet, get out in the sunlight, no sunscreen, no sunglasses, sunlight exposure, very important. Organic diet, whole foods. Don't get the vaccine. That's all of my advice to people. And I think you can really get a huge improvement in your health if you make those changes.
Thank you, Stephanie. This is simple advice, folks. It may be hard because of the pressures we're under to, you've got to get this vaccine to go to school or to work, but there's too much information now. And you've shared for our listeners exactly why this is so dangerous. So I thank you. Let's get you back on next time you have another massive revelation, which will probably be,
we'll probably be a weekly guest.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure. Very much enjoyed talking to you. So stay safe and we'll see you.
You too. Thank you. Welcome to Against the Wind. Neil Miller, what a privilege and honor it is to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
I wanted to get your take on COVID. I mean, everybody's talking COVID. You dive into science. You're a scientist and a published author of not just books, but scientific articles. What's your take on COVID?
It's absolute nonsense to believe that VAERS isn't an important vaccine safety assessment tool, because the CDC's and FDA's use of the VAERS database is evidence that VAERS is a valid and credible resource. Okay, so now we're going to get into the actual VAERS data. Over 752,000 reports any event, okay? Now, just to put that in perspective, in the last 30 years, there has not been over 700,000 reports in total. Just since the COVID vaccine has been introduced, and we're talking about a little over a year and a half, there have already been 752,000 total reports and over 15,000, almost 16,000 deaths that were reported. VAERS is a passive reporting system, so it's underreported by approximately 50 to 100 times.
That's just amazing. That fact that we're seeing in just one season of COVID-19 vaccination, more adverse events from total reports to deaths exceeding what we've had in 30 years of reporting. Have you ever seen anything like this?
nothing. These are very serious safety signals, and that this vaccine should have been halted immediately while they investigated further. Almost 37% of all of those hospitalizations took place within 3 days post-vaccination, and nearly 50% of them took place within 1 week post-vaccination. Again, this is a very significant safety signal. Now we're going to look at deaths. 15,937 deaths, okay? And on the day of vaccination, 13% of them took place. And 33% of all deaths reported to VAERS after COVID-19 vaccination occurred within 3 days. And 45.9, almost 46% occurred within 7 days. Again, very significant safety signal. If I was on that regulatory agency, I would have called for an immediate halt and investigation. Here's the pattern. Very low numbers in the 12 to 17 year group, very low numbers in the 18 to 44 age group, very low numbers in the 45 to 64 year age group, and then they jump when we get to the senior citizens, and then they jump significantly when we get to the elderly above 75 years of age at 9.4% of all reports ended in a death or a report of a death. Okay, so I'm going to summarize what this really means. Although the elderly are most at risk of serious harm from a COVID infection, the vaccine appears to be especially dangerous in the elderly age groups. That's the significant thing that we're really looking at here. It turns out that the vaccine is especially dangerous for these elderly age groups. But we're going to look at something here that I find to be incredible that this is permitted. So here's the official definition. People are considered fully vaccinated 2 weeks after their second dose in a two-dose series, or 2 weeks after their first dose when only one dose is required. What are they labeling these other periods prior to that two-week period? If you get the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine, you're going to get dose one. You're going to have to wait 1 to 14 days. In that 1 to 14 days, the CDC and the FDA and health authorities are actually labeling if there's an adverse event or if there is a breakthrough case of COVID that takes place in this 1 to 14 day period, it's actually getting reported in the unvaccinated column. It's only until the 15 to 28 days period begins that if an adverse event or a breakthrough case takes place, somebody actually catches COVID, where they'll label as that individual was partially vaccinated. And it's only after you get the second dose and wait 2 weeks that you're considered fully vaccinated. But I was curious as to what's going on in this 2 week period. And I did some additional research and I found out that if you have an adverse reaction or if you die in this 2 week period after you got that first dose, they're reporting that adverse reaction and or that death in the unvaccinated column. Now, that is scientific fraud.
That's insane.
Yeah. I mean, don't you agree with me that this is nonsense?
Absolutely. And so when we hear on the news the reporting about all these events happening in the unvaxxed, people are not aware, as you and I are, and especially as your data that you've just shown us makes very clear, since most of the adverse events happen in the first few days or the first week, that's a period at which people are being classified as unvaxxed.
That is just astounding to me that this is permitted to occur. Yeah, so now I'm going to show you some more fraud, some more scientific fraud. Okay, so the CDC recommended that all pregnant women of all trimesters receive the COVID vaccine. And they did this before they had any safety data. Okay. They waited until millions of pregnant women around the country received the COVID vaccine. And then they decided they were going to actually investigate whether or not the vaccine is safe. They're actually going to do the actual science. Now, this is backwards science. So the CDC and FDA conducted a safety study of 827 pregnant women who received the COVID vaccine. Here's their conclusions. Preliminary findings did not show obvious safety signals among pregnant persons who received the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. So they're giving it their stamp of approval.
I love their use of the word obvious. It was obvious to anybody with a pair of eyes and a brain.
Well, also, the way they buried the actual facts in the study, which I'm about to show, which I'm about to reveal, they hid the obvious safety signals. They tried to bury it, and then they tried to gaslight the entire world population, you know, by publishing it in the New England Journal of Medicine. Okay, so the CDC FDA study on COVID-19 vaccination during pregnancy was deceptive. Table 4 tells the full story. Okay, so here's table 4 in that study. And what we want to look at is right here where I've got the arrow, spontaneous abortion. There were 104 spontaneous abortions out of 827 vaccinated pregnant women. That comes to 12.6%. If you look at the bottom where they snuck in at the bottom of table 4 and they let us know surreptitiously that a total of 700 participants, 84.6% of those 827 pregnant women received their first eligible dose of the COVID vaccine in the third trimester. What does that mean? That means that those women were unable to have a spontaneous abortion. It was just not possible because they had the vaccine after the outcome period that's being studied. Okay, so you can't count those 700 people in the denominator out of 127 women that were eligible to have a spontaneous abortion. Actually, 82%, 81.9% of the women in this study that got a COVID vaccine within that first or early second trimester had a spontaneous abortion. And that is a huge safety signal. And once again, we should have been doubly cautious, and they should have immediately called for a suspension, if not in all trimesters of pregnancy. At the very least, they should have said, you know what, this is a safety signal in the first and second trimesters, and so pregnant women should not receive a COVID vaccine during those trimesters.
But yeah, this is such massive harm. And there's no reason to think that if it's this dangerous in the first trimester, that it's going to suddenly become safe in the later part of pregnancy. I mean, yes, it's less dangerous, but absolutely, this is hands down. This should be all over the news. Do not step near this vaccine if you're pregnant or might even be becoming pregnant in the near future.
The CDC, FDA, and the World Health Organization control all of the data. We, the people, must have access to all of the data. Independent researchers and scientists must demand complete transparency and access to all safety and efficacy data.
You covered SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome relating to vaccines, in such a scientifically clear way that I wanted you to touch quickly on that for our audience, because parents who have a newborn, an infant, sudden infant death is death within the first 12 months. And there's nothing more tragic. I mean, you've got your special baby home, and there's, you love them, and they just die. They stop breathing and they don't come back. Tell us what you found.
Okay, so I wanted to investigate vaccines and their potential relationship to sudden infant death. This is a paper that was just recently published a couple of months ago in Toxicology Reports. So of 2,605 infant deaths reported to VAERS from 1990 to 2019, 58% clustered within 3 days post-vaccination. 78% of infant deaths reported to VAERS clustered within 7 days post-vaccination. If there's no connection, if there's no relationship between the vaccines and the deaths, then you would expect a random distribution of these reports. But you're not finding that. You're finding a clustering of these deaths in the early post-vaccination period. Here's a study that I looked at that was a confidential report issued by GlaxoSmithKline. Glaxo is a vaccine manufacturer based in Europe. They produce a hexavalent vaccine, a single injection that contains six vaccines in that one shot, okay? And they're giving this to babies. It's doing a number on these babies. Lots of adverse reactions, serious adverse reactions. Well, GlaxoSmithKline put together their own report, and they tried to hide this and bury this report, but the Italian court made them release it so that it became public. And I gained access to this report. But if you look at the data quite simply and divide it into two 10-day periods, 97% of sudden infant deaths occurred in the first 10 days, and just 3% occurred in the next 10 days. About 1/4 of all studies show that infant deaths take place about 25% or about 1/4 take place within 1 day post-vaccination. Mm. About 50% take place within 3 days, and about 3/4 take place within 7 days.
Well, you're going to present next for me, because you did this last weekend at the conference. And what everybody wants is to show us the vaccinated and unvaccinated studies, because the CDC, the NIH, the big health plans that have this data refuse to do this study. And I know you've been involved in a couple of them. I was involved in one of them. Can you summarize those for us?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're going to look over 4 peer-reviewed vaccinated versus unvaccinated studies. Now, here's the title page of my recent study with Brian. There's a couple of things. We're going to go through these very, very quickly. The main findings are in Table 5. And what we looked at were allergies, autism, gastrointestinal disorders, asthma, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and ear infections. And what we found were that vaccinated children were significantly more likely than unvaccinated children to develop adverse health conditions. You know, as a scientist, you're going to look at, you know, or as a statistician, you're going to look at the odds ratio, you're going to look at confidence intervals, and you're going to look at the p-values. And all of them show that the unvaccinated children were statistically less likely to develop all of these adverse health outcomes when compared to the vaccinated children. Table 9 is my favorite. If you vaccinate your child and don't breastfeed your child, they are very much more likely to end up with an adverse health outcome, especially when you compare to children that are unvaccinated and breastfed. And a consistent linear increase was observed for allergies, autism, asthma, and ear infections. We also had information about whether or not the pregnant women had a vaginal delivery or whether they delivered the babies via C-section. Okay, and again, the children who were vaccinated and born via C-section had the worst health outcomes. Now, why might that happen? Why would that occur? What could be going on? Well, in the paper, we offer at least 2 possible biologically plausible explanations. One of those biologically plausible explanations is that when that baby comes down that birth canal, they're picking up the microbiome from the mother, from the mom. And that is getting those babies off to a great start. And babies that are born via C-section don't have that advantage. Don't get that they're bypassing that advantage. A second reason is a lot of women that go through a C-section. I think a higher percentage of those mothers and those babies have a more difficult time breastfeeding, and it's possible that breastfeeding that there less of these babies are actually getting that colostrum and all the good nutrients from breastfeeding, which is reflected in all of these high odds ratios. And once again, we have a consistent linear increase, which was observed for allergies, autism, and gastrointestinal disorders. Here's the previous study Brian and I conducted back in 2020. We looked at developmental delays, asthma, ear infections, and if we looked over at this column of odds ratios, We had vaccinated children were over 2 times more likely to be diagnosed with a developmental delay when compared to the children that were unvaccinated, and 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with asthma, and again, 2 times more likely to be diagnosed with ear infections. Table 7 is a quartile analysis where we divided the groups into vaccines. This analysis gives some evidence of a dose response relationship. So again, it's just another way to confirm the findings that vaccinated children are more likely to have adverse reactions and have worse health outcomes when compared to unvaccinated children. Now here's your paper, and I do just a brief summary with this. This is James Linesweiler and Paul Thomas using data from Paul Thomas's practice. In this study, vaccinated versus unvaccinated children were assessed for billed office visits per adverse health outcome. Overall, unvaccinated children were found to be healthier than vaccinated children. And this paper contains important findings, but your paper got retracted. And we all know that, you know, they were gunning for you, you know, and they wanted to punish you bad.
Well, we showed in real world data, everybody born into my practice was included in this data set over a period of over 10 years. And the findings were dramatic and significant, highly significant. I mean, just the same thing you found in your research. The difference in health outcomes in so many different variables were just tremendous in both infections, allergies, neurodevelopment, especially all those three categories. Unvaxxed just did so well. And I've known that by working with so many unvaxxed families. Those kids are just hands down alert, healthy, developing so well. But we used this build rate of cumulative rates of diagnoses was what they objected to. It was peer reviewed and accepted. But this one complaint where, well, that's not the right metric. You're supposed to just do a yes, no analysis. And in our case here, we were trying to make is it's actually more sensitive. You get more robust data by looking at the severity of the condition, right? So if you look at how many times a person comes in for a given condition gives you an idea of how serious their condition is. That was all it was. We also did it the old fashioned way as well. It's all in that paper. Anyway, thank you for summarizing all that data. Yeah. As a scientist who really knows how to interpret studies, what do you think is the most important thing people need to know? You've been doing this for a long time.
One is that many studies are unreliable and cannot be trusted. The second thing I want to point out for everyone to remember, there are multiple ways to manipulate data, and this happens more often than most people realize. And the third thing I want to point out is our regulatory agencies have been captured by the industry that they have been commissioned to oversee. This is a study that shows that top scientists in the United States regularly engage in scientific misconduct that threatens the integrity of science. These are researchers, over 3,000 researchers that they surveyed. These were scientists funded by the National Institutes of Health, and 33% of them admitted that they engage in questionable scientific behavior during the previous 3 years. This is a direct quote from the study authors. Our findings reveal a range of questionable practices that are striking in their breadth and prevalence. U.S. scientists engage in a range of behaviors extending far beyond fabrication, falsification, or plagiarism that can damage the integrity of science.
That's crazy. And this is the thing. So maybe that sort of leads you in. I wanted to ask you about your final thoughts for viewers who are hearing every day in the news that these experts in public health and in the government, that they're following the science.
Well, I just want to say that experts are not following the best science and are not being transparent with the data. For example, more than 100 studies now have already been published that show that vitamin D supplementation is protective against cases, hospitalizations, and deaths associated with COVID. Yet health authorities are not recommending or providing vitamin D. Okay, so we must fight for transparency and accountability. Also, vaccine manufacturers are not being held liable for their products, and the media has shirked their responsibility as investigative journalists. Instead, they have become mouthpieces for the industry. As a nation in distress, we can and must do much, much better.
Amen to that. Thank you, Neil. I mean, this was a speed course in science for our viewers. But folks, this is what you get here. This is what you need. Pay attention to the actual science and to a man who's done more for science than almost anyone I know in a short period of time. So you've really pushed the needle in the right direction. And I thank
you, Paul. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity to share this important information.
Yeah. Thanks again. And all the best to you, Neil. Welcome to our favorite section in the news. Bernadette Pager, Public Policy Director of Informed Choice Washington and the host of An Informed Life Radio and so much more. So glad to have you back this week and welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. It's good to be here. There's an awful lot going on and a lot we need our viewers to do.
There sure is. I think you were going to highlight for us something from a person I hold dear to my heart, Jeremy Hammond, who wrote that book that's over my shoulder. The Attack on Informed Consent, which was my story. He's done a lot of amazing work right now, something on natural immunity. Maybe you can share that with our audience.
Yes, yes. Yeah, hopefully you can see that there. Jeremy R. Hammond, go to jeremyrhammond.com. He is doing a deep dive investigation into the science and politics of natural immunity to SARS-CoV-2. In short, natural immunity is very strong, broad, and long-lasting, and the politics is silencing that. We need to share the information, so go find this series of articles that Jeremy R. Hammond has done, and that will help you educate your legislators, your doctors, your teachers, educate everybody about the power of that. And of course, we know the silence of the early treatment protocols is what also is driving what they are trying to do with these vaccine products.
Oh, absolutely. When I was with Dr. McCullough at a recent conference, he is so pro-natural immunity. Of course, he had the infection himself and he has tried to get himself reinfected. He cannot. And he feels that natural immunity will probably be lifelong or certainly many, many years. It is the way out as opposed to the vaccine program that is clearly failing. Mm-hmm. I thought today we might focus on myocarditis. This is sort of a relatively new finding of massive significance, especially in the younger folks. And what have you found on that?
Yeah, myocarditis is really huge. I'm going to play for you a little bit of this video from Steve Kirch. This is in regarding to CDC information, what they are telling us, and they're trying to downplay something extremely important.
They did say that on May 22nd, a few young vaccine recipients had been affected by myocarditis. They had gotten reports in from a few young vaccine recipients. Well, in reality, they got reports in from 615 affected people, boys in that age range, and 1,000 in May. Now, that's not a few. And what's interesting is that the five-year rate for these events is zero. For over 5 years, you look at previous vaccines, you get zero counts, and here you're looking at 1,000 events in a month.
Yeah. A report on myocarditis adverse events, not only does it show high rates of myocarditis in young people following vaccination, but there appears to be elevated what's called troponin levels, which is a marker of myocarditis in many people, but there's no follow-up. There's no routine follow-up of these troponin levels to see. And what can happen is you get subclinical inflammation, undiagnosed, which could be leading to a whole lot of very dangerous heart issues in the future. The rates of injury to the children are much higher from the shots than to the natural infection, which we know would provide them very long-lasting immunity. Where's the risk-benefit conversation happening, Dr. Paul?
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Both Dr. McCullough, who treats a lot of COVID patients, and I, as a pediatrician, don't see very many cases. We don't have the vaccine in my office. It wasn't until very recently that teenagers could even get the vaccines for COVID-19. But I've had a patient of my own, a teenager in his mid-teens, hospitalized with sky-high troponin levels in the thousands.
Wow.
In serious medical situation, he lived, but he will likely have lifelong heart issues, as is the case for Dr. McCullough's patient, who's still just barely out of the hospital. It's a rough road. And both McCullough and I, and you're saying it too, Bernadette, if we don't test people after they've had the vaccine to see what's happening to their hearts, we don't know if 100% or 50% of those who get this vaccine are taking a hit to their heart. They're not testing, so we simply don't know. But the numbers of just the hospitalizations for heart myocarditis issues is astonishing. One in 300 and something for that younger age group. I mean, that is horrific.
Exactly. And that's just one medical issue. Viewers, all of us parents, you are the heroes. We are the heroes. And we can do this. And in so many states, children without parental consent at fairly young ages can go get these dangerous shots. We have got to stop this.
It is absolutely shocking, even in my own clinic where people are very aware of informed consent, the number of teenagers who have already gone on their own to a pharmacy somewhere and gotten this shot. The peer pressure is immense. People are not aware of the information that we have. And so when all you hear is the sound bites on television, the sky is falling, the solution is the vaccine, and you take that as fact when it's actual total propaganda and misinformation. And we're wringing our hands. How do we help reach our friends? And so I agree with you, Bernadette. People go to those organizations that Bernadette just highlighted on that final slide there, and put on your cape, put on your boots, and stand for your own right to medical freedom and bodily integrity. We now know this is a failed vaccine program. It's a dangerous vaccine program. And I am in danger for saying that because I happen to be a licensed physician, at least for now. But a lot of us are speaking up because we cannot remain silent any longer. We have no long-term data. So until we do, precautionary principle, protect yourselves.
Exactly. And this pertains to every brand of the product. It's not just the mRNA, it's the DNA and any potential coming along.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Bernadette, and all the best in your move. I know you've got big things ahead for yourself and we'll chat again soon.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. Take care.
You too. Dr. Paul here. Doctorsandscience.com is where you go to get access to my exclusive members-only section. This is how you, the viewers, support our work. We have no sponsors. We are fully supported by you, our viewers. What do you get in the members section? It's quite a list. You get access to a couple of my ebooks. The first one is the authoritative reference list for my Vaccine Friendly Plan book. I also have written a book, very extensive, called Everyday Health, that covers pretty much what I think you should be doing if you want to live a healthy life in this world today. But there's so much more. We have a live Q&A every week after the show with yours truly, Dr. Paul, answering your questions. Submit your questions online and I will tackle as many of them as I possibly can and try to answer to the best of my ability whatever burning questions you have. In addition to this, you get transcripts of every show. We have other bonus content. And I think one of the huge bonus content pieces is the PowerPoints of the talks I'm giving as I travel around the country. People are always asking me, how can we get those PowerPoints? This is how you do it. Head on over to doctorsandscience.com and become a member and join the team of Against the Wind. Help me spread the truth and share this on social media and with your friends at doctorsandscience.com. I look forward to running with you against the wind. Go to our website, doctorsandscience.com. Sign up, donate if you can, and let's make this the weekly show the nation's been waiting for. I'm Dr. Paul.